Your eyes? They haven't changed at all.
Oh, she peered dubiously at the glass. You think?
Well, they were fine before you started squinting. Take my word for it. He lowered the mirror, placed it on the table.
Kitty, he said, I have to tell you something. The demons have broken out across London. After I found you, I tried to set the staff of Gladstone going. But, he sighed, I couldn't make it. It's not the incantations. I've got the knowledge that I didn't have before. It's just I haven't got the physical strength to force my will upon it. And without the staff, we can't face up to Nauda.
Nathaniel, there may be other magicians left alive and unpossessed. I haven't gone looking yet. But even if we can round up some allies and get their djinn on our side, Nauda's much too strong. The staff was our only hope.
That's not so.
Kitty leaned forward in the chair. It was true what he'd said. She was moving a little more easily now. To begin with, everything had felt uncomfortable and misaligned, as if she were out of sync with her bones and sinew.
I didn't go to the other place just for fun, she said primly. You got the staff. I found Bartimaeus. Now all we need to do is put them together.
She grinned at him. The magician shook his head in vexation. Meaning what?
Ah. Now you're not going to like this part.
Chapter 32 Bartimaeus. The sulphur cloud contracted into an ailing column of smoke that slouched in the middle of the pentacle. It dribbled up toward the ceiling with the awesome force of water spurting from a drinking fountain. Two timorous yellow eyes materialized in the heart of the smoke. They blinked anxiously. I was having second thoughts. The dark-haired youth stood in the pentacle opposite, leaning heavily on the staff. I recognized it straight away. Difficult not to. The aura of the talisman beat upon my circle with the intensity of a solar flare. My essence quailed at the proximity. Bad. I was too weak. I should not have agreed to this. Mind you, it looked to me as if the magician was of similar mind. His face was the delightful colour of off-milk. He drew himself up as best he could, and tried to look imposing.
"Bartimaeus?"
"Nathaniel?"
We each strove to make the sounds curt, assertive, growling. Neither of us quite succeeded. His voice had the kind of pitch usually reserved for bats and dog whistles, while mine warbled like that of an elderly spinster requesting a cucumber sandwich with her cup of tea. He cleared his throat, gazed at the floor, scratched his head, hummed a few odd notes, did everything, in fact, but look me straight in the eye, like a man should. Not that I was much better. Instead of billowing ominously, the column of smoke seemed intent on winding its rising threads into pretty braidy patterns. If we'd been left to ourselves, I'd probably have ended up knitting a virtual cardigan or something, but after a few seconds of high-quality dithering, a rude interruption came.
"Get on with it!"
No prizes for guessing who that was. Magician and smoke swiveled in their circles, coughing and muttering. Both wore expressions of wounded aggravation.
I know, Kitty said. I don't envy either of you. Just do it. We haven't time to waste.
I must say she was looking rather more spry than I expected. Okay, she was a bit frail-looking, and she had grey hair, and her skin was lined and aged, but she was nothing like Ptolemy had been. And her eyes were as bright as a bird's. They shone with the light of what they'd seen. I regarded her with mingled reverence and compassion. "Keep your knickers on," I said. "We're getting to it."
"That's right," Nathaniel agreed. "Can't rush these things." "Like you'd know," she snorted. "What's the hold-up?"
"Well," he began, "it's just..." "For my part," I said in tones of quiet dignity, "I agreed to this proposal on the assumption that my host would be of moderate physical quality. Now, having viewed him, I'm having doubts." The magician glared at me.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Well, you wouldn't buy a horse without seeing it, would you? I'm allowed an inspection. Let's see your teeth."
"Get lost."
"I'm sorry," I said. "He's rubbish. Can barely stand. Skin's been burned by a pestilence, and his shoulder's bleeding. I bet he's got worms and all.
The girl frowned.
What's that about his shoulder? Where?
Nathaniel made a dismissive gesture and winced.
It's nothing. Not a problem. Why didn't you tell me?
Because, he snarled, as you keep saying, we haven't got time.
Fair point, I said.
In fact, I'm not sure I want to go ahead with it either, the magician continued, rewarding me with an unpleasant look.
I don't see how it could possibly work. He's far too weak to help with the staff, as well as being utterly vile in a thousand ways. Heaven knows what damage he'd do to me. It's like inviting a herd of hogs to come and live in your bedroom.
Is that so? Well, I'm not too enamoured of being encased inside your earthly gunge, I cried. There's a darn sight too much drippy stuff going on in there. All that phlegm and congealing wax and...
Shut up! Kitty shouted.
It has to be said, her journey hadn't affected her lungs.
Both of you, shut up! My city is being destroyed out there, and we need that staff to work. The only way we can think of to do that is by combining your knowledge, Nathaniel, with your energies, Bartimaeus. All right. Both of you might be a little inconvenienced, but...
I looked at Nathaniel.
Hear that?
A little, she says.
He shook his head in deep disgust. Tell me about it. But it won't last long. Hours at the most. Then, Nathaniel, you can dismiss Bartimaeus for good. Wait, he said. I want a guarantee that this creature won't try to destroy my mind. It'd be just like him.
Yeah, right, I cried, and burn my only ticket out of there. I'm not hanging out in your head for all eternity, pal. Don't worry, I need that dismissal. I won't touch nothing.
You better not.
We glared at each other for a spell. The girl clapped her hands.
Okay. Posturing over? Good. I didn't ruin my health just to sit here and watch you two idiots fight. Can we please get on with it?
The magician sniffed.
All right.
The smoke coiled sullenly skyward. All right.
That's better.
I would never have done it, had it not been for the girl. But she had been quite correct, back there in the other place, to appeal to me in Ptolemy's name. As she'd instantly perceived, that was my weak spot, my open wound. And 2,000 years of accumulated cynicism hadn't managed to heal it up, try as I might. For all that long and weary time, I'd carried round the memory of his hope, that jinn and humans might one day act together, without malice, without treachery, without slaughter. Let's face it, it was a stupid idea, and I didn't believe it for an instant. There was simply too much evidence to the contrary. But Ptolemy had believed it, and that was enough. Just the echo of his faith was powerful enough to win me over when Kitty repeated his great gesture and came across to meet me. She'd renewed his bond, and once that was done, my fate was sealed. No matter what the groans and cussing of my better judgment, I'd have thrown myself into a pit of fire for Ptolemy, and the same was true for Kitty now. Mind you, pit of fire? Vat of acid? Bed of nails? Any of them would have been preferable to what I was about to do. In one circle, the magician was busy psyching himself up. He was getting his line straight, readying the incantation. In the other, the column of smoke drifted back and forth like a caged tiger. I noticed that both pentacles had had holes scratched in their perimeters to allow me immediate transit from one side to the other. Boy, they were trusting. I could have nipped out there and then and gobbled them both up before departing with a smile and a song. Part of me itched to do it as well, just to see the expression on my old master's face. It had been ages since I'd devoured a magician. A couple of 100 years, in fact. A Czech master of mine had been inclined to plumpness. I used to criticize him for his lack of condition, gradually building up in him a sense of annoyed defiance. One night I challenged him to touch his toes while in his pentacle. He succeeded valiantly, but in so doing stuck his backside over the edge of the circle, allowing me to break my bonds. And sure enough, he was a bit fatty, but he still tasted pretty good. But of course,
Unscheduled devouring was off Kitty's agenda for the day. Regretfully, I resisted the temptation. There was also the small matter of my condition. Even so simple a form as the smoke was proving hard to maintain. I needed protection, and I needed it fast. "Sometime today," I said, "if you don't mind." The magician ran nervous fingers through his hair and turned to Kitty. "Any snide comments when he's in there, I'll dismiss him right off, staff or no staff. You tell him." She tapped a foot. "I'm waiting, Nathaniel." A curse, a rub of the face. Then he was off. The incantation was a tad improvised, I felt. Didn't have the elegance and refinement I was used to. The claws snare this cursed demon Bartimaeus and compress him with unmerciful precision was a little crude, for instance, and could have been misinterpreted. But it seemed to do the trick. One moment the column of smoke was rising innocently in its circle. The next it had been sucked up and outward, over the break in my pentacle, over the break in his, and drawn down, 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 toward my master's head. I braced myself. I glimpsed him squeeze his eyes tight shut. Plunk. Gone. The pain was gone. That was my first sensation. That was all that mattered. It was like a curtain had suddenly been flung open, and everything had gone from dark to light. It was like being plunged into an ice-cold spring. It was a little like returning to the other place after months of slavery. The criss-cross lattices of hurt that ran throughout my essence just fell away like scabs, left me suddenly feeling whole. It was like being refreshed and rebuilt and reborn all at the same time. My essence surged with a terrible joy, the kind I hadn't felt on Earth since my first summonings back in Sumer, back when I thought my energies could cope with anything. That didn't last long, of course. "Oh, Bartimaeus, could you just irrigate the Fertile Crescent? Could you just divert the Euphrates here and here? Look, while you're at it, do you mind just planting a few million wheat seeds up and down the floodplain? Thanks." Didn't even give me a dibble. By the time I got to Ur, I wasn't surging with any of that terrible joy. Oh, no. My back was killing me. I hadn't realized how much of my recent weakness had simply been down to the accumulated pain. The moment it was gone, I was 10 times the jinni that I'd been before. No wonder Fakwal and the others had recommended it so. I let out a cry of triumph, which echoed curiously, as if I were trapped in a bottle. Believe me, I know all about bottle acoustics. I spent much of the 6th century in an old sesame oil jar, corked with wax, bobbing about in the Red Sea. No one heard my hollers. In the end, an old fisherman set me free, by which time I was desperate enough to grant him several wishes. I erupted out in the form of a smoking giant, did a few lightning bolts, and bent to ask him his desire. Poor old boy had dropped dead of a heart attack. There should be a moral there, but for the life of me I can't see one. An instant later came another cry, curiously loud and all around. It deafened me. With this distraction I awoke to my surroundings, to what cloaked me and shielded me from the world. Not to put too fine a point on it was human flesh. Nathaniel's, to be precise. Where the soup in Fakwal's tureen had given me a modicum of protection from the deathly silver on all sides, Nathaniel's body made a much better job of it. My essence was immersed in bone and blood and little thready things that I suppose might have been sinew. I'd spread throughout him from hair to toe. I felt the pulsing of his heart, the endless flow across the veins, the whispery wheeze-box of his lungs. I saw the flitting drifts of electricity moving back and forth across the brain. I saw, less certainly, the thoughts they signified. And for a moment there I marvelled. It was like stepping into a great building, some holy mosque or shrine, and glimpsing its perfection. Something airy, built of clay. Then came the secondary wonder, that such a ropey thing could actually work at all. So fragile was it, so weak and cumbrous, so tied to earth. How easy it would have been to take control, to treat the body like a cart or chariot, a humble vehicle to be ridden where I pleased. The faintest of temptations ran through me. Without a second's pause, I could have closed in upon the brain and damped down its little energies, set myself to pull the levers to keep the mechanism going. No doubt Nauder and Fakwal and Narian and all the rest had been pleased to do this. It was their revenge in microcosm, their triumph over humanity, carried out in miniature. But that was not for me. Not that it wasn't tempting, mind. I've never been the biggest fan of Nathaniel's voice. It was just about bearable at a distance, but now it was as if I were tied up inside a loudspeaker on full volume. When he spoke, the reverberations hummed and quivered through my essence. "Kitty!" that great galumphing elephant of a voice cried. "I feel such energy!" Her voice came to me slightly muffled, refracted through his ears. "Tell me, what does it feel like?" "It ripples through me. I feel so light. I could leap to the stars." A logical sensation from his point of view. He had absorbed me, a being of fire and air. He hesitated, as if embarrassed at his unmagicianish enthusiasm. "Kitty," he said, "do I look any different?" "No, except you're less stooped. Can you open your eyes?" He opened them for the first time, and I looked out. It was an odd double vision to begin with. For a moment it was all blurred and vague. I suppose that was his human vision, so weak and halting. Then I shifted my essence into alignment, and things got clearer. I ratcheted through the seven planes and heard Nathaniel gasp. "You'd never believe it!" he bellowed in my ear. "Kitty, it's like everything's got more colours, more dimensions, and around you there's such a glow!" That was her aura. Always stronger than average, since her visit to the other place it had waxed into noonday splendour. Just as Ptolemy's had done. I never saw another human one like it. Ripples of wonder ran through Nathaniel's body. His brain fizzed with it. "You're so beautiful!" he said. "Oh, only now?" He'd really fallen into that one. It was the tone of stupefied amazement that had sunk him. Nothing changes. Nefertiti was always doing that to Akhenaten, sidling over while he was doing the crop accounts, asking him how she looked in her nice new headdress. He never learned. "No, I only meant—" I thought it was time to assert myself. The poor sap wasn't doing so well on his own. I took control of his larynx. "Do you mind keeping your voice down?" I said. "I can't hear yourself think." He went very quiet then. They both did. I felt him raise a hand to his mouth, as if he'd just hiccuped in company. "That's right," I said. "Me. What, did you think I'd be all nice and quiet for you? Think again, sonny. There are two of us in this body now. Check this out." To prove my point, I lifted one of his fingers and methodically picked his nose. He uttered a squawk of protest.
"Stop that!"
I lowered the arm. "That's not all I can do if I put your mind to it. Sheesh! It's a strange little world in here. Like being dunked in chocolate mousse, except without the nice flavour. Some of your thoughts, Nathaniel. Well, if Kitty only knew." He wrested control of his mouth again.
"Enough! I'm in charge. We agreed that. We must act in harmony or risk destruction."
Kitty spoke from her chair.
"He's right, Bartimaeus. We've wasted too much time already. You've got to work together."
"Fine," I said, "but he needs to listen to me. I know more about Fakwal and Nauder than he does. I'll be able to preempt their actions. And I can move his body around, all right. Watch this." I'd figured out the leg muscles nicely. I bent them, stretched them. My essence did the rest. From a standing start, we leapt over the desk to the far side of the room. "Not bad, eh?" I chuckled. "Smooth as silk." I bent the legs again, gave a stretch. At exactly the same time, the magician attempted to walk in the opposite direction. Our body floundered, one leg up in the air, the other about 170 degrees akimbo from it. We did the splits, uttered harmonic cries of mild discomfort, and crashed upon the carpet.
"Yeah," Kitty said. really smooth.
I allowed Nathaniel to organize the business of getting to his feet again.
I knew that would happen, he snarled. This is hopeless.
You just don't like taking orders, I snapped back. Don't like your slave calling the shots. Once a magician, always a...
Quiet, Kitty said.
Whether it was her aura or not, something about her nowadays brooked no argument. We stood quiet and let her speak.
If you took a moment to stop squabbling, she went on, you'd see that you're acting together far better than Nauda and the others are managing in their stolen bodies. Fakwal was at home in Hopkins, but he'd had practice. The others were almost helpless.
She's right, Nathaniel said. Nauda couldn't walk. It took a jinni to get to the nub of the matter. There are two crucial differences, I said. I haven't destroyed your mind. That's got to help. Also, I know your birth name. I'll bet that gives me deeper access to you than the other spirits can hope to gain. There you go, you see. I knew it would come in useful one day. The magician scratched his chin. Maybe. Our philosophical speculations were curtailed by an impatient cry.
Whatever, Kitty said. Just tell each other what you plan, and you should avoid stupid pratfalls. Now, how about the staff?
How about the staff? All this time we had held it in our fist. And even through Nathaniel's insulating bones and flesh, I could feel its imminence. I sensed the restless writhing of the great beings trapped inside it. Dimly heard their pleading to be free. The locks and binding seals that Gladstone had wrought upon the wood were still as strong as the day he fixed them. Fortunate, that, since if released all at once, the pent-up energies would have leveled a city block. Using an item like this is a bit like unscrewing the top of a cola bottle. No, perhaps it is moderately more exciting. Imagine shaking the bottle first. Then you slowly, slowly turn the top. The secret is to turn it enough to get just a little fizz. Then the magician can direct that power where he wants. Too much turning or doing it too fast, and your hands get sticky. In a manner of speaking. Notable buildings destroyed by careless use of talismans include Alexandria's library and the Pharos lighthouse, Babylon's hanging gardens, the citadel of Great Zimbabwe, and the underwater palace of Koth. Kitty was watching us narrowly.
Do you think you can activate it?
Yes, we said. Nathaniel held the staff with both hands. I allowed him to manipulate our limbs here. This was his moment. We needed his formula to start the process. His direction. I was just providing the extra energies, the strength behind his will. We stood with legs slightly apart, body braced for the impact. He began to speak. While he did so, I looked through his eyes around the little room. There was Kitty, sitting in the chair. Her aura more than matched the staff's. Beyond was a doorway, broken in by some small blast. Piled up on the floor were several inferno sticks and elemental spheres. Nathaniel had brought them. He'd used a detonation cube to destroy the door. He'd been so anxious about Kitty, he'd forgotten the pain in his shoulder, forgotten his weariness for a time. A curious thing, feeling a man's mind move. It shifted like a sleeper in the dark, while elsewhere his conscious thoughts churned out the incantation. Faces floated past me. Kitty's, an older woman's, others that I didn't recognize at all. And then, a shock this, Ptolemy's too, clear as a bell. So long since I had seen it. 2,000 years. But, of course, this image was nothing but a memory of me. Time to concentrate. I felt my energies being drawn upon, sucked out through Nathaniel's words and converted into bonds around the staff. The incantation was coming to its close. Gladstone's staff shuddered. Pale streams of light ran up its length and congregated by the carved pentacle at the end. We felt the beings within pressing against the crack we had created in their prison. We felt Gladstone's locking mechanisms struggling to seal themselves. We denied them both. Nathaniel's chant came to an end. The staff pulsed once. A brilliant white light filled the room on every plane. We stumbled where we stood. Nathaniel shut our eyes. Then the light fell back. Equilibrium was reached. All was still. The room was quiet. Almost too faintly to be heard, the staff of Gladstone hummed in our grasp. As one, we turned to where Kitty sat watching in her chair. "Ready now," we said. Chapter 33. Nathaniel. Just for a moment, when the staff had been activated and the Jinni's energies had flowed through him to keep its power in check, Nathaniel remembered the wound in his shoulder. He got an indignant stab of pain, a sudden wooziness in his head. Then his new strength waxed in him once again, and the frailty vanished. He felt better than he had ever done. His body still echoed with the sensation of that first instant, when Bartimaeus's powers had fused within him. It was like an electric shock, a surge that threatened to carry him off the floor, to deny gravity altogether. All his weight and weariness fell away. He burned with life. With sudden clarity, his mind seemed sharper, newly whetted. He perceived the Jinni's nature, understood its ceaseless urge for movement, change, and transformation. He sensed how harsh a fate it was for this nature to be forcibly restricted, to be pent up among earthly solid things. He glimpsed, only blearily at first, an endless succession of images, memories, imprints, stretching back into a terrible abyss of time. It gave him a feeling not unlike vertigo. All his senses were afire. His fingers felt each whirl and grain upon the staff. His ears caught its minute hum. Best of all, he saw and understood each plane, all seven of them. The room was bathed in the colours of a dozen auras, from the staff, from himself, and most extraordinary of all, from Kitty. Through its glow, her face seemed smooth and young again. Her hair shone like flames. He could have gazed at her forever. "Stop that nonsense right now. I feel quite sick." If a wretched Jinni hadn't been gabbling in his head. "I wasn't doing anything," he thought. "Not much you weren't. Staff's up and running. We need to go." "Yes." Warily, in case the Jinni had other plans for his legs, Nathaniel turned to Kitty. "You should stay here." "I'm feeling stronger." To Nathaniel's alarm, she inched forward in the chair, and supporting her weight with shaking hands, got to her feet. "I can walk," she said. "Even so, you're not coming with us." He felt the Jinni stir within his mind. Its voice echoed from his mouth. As before, the effect was disconcerting. Also, it rather tickled. "Nathaniel's right," Bartimaeus said. "You're far too weak. If his memory is up to scratch, which I doubt, there may still be prisoners in the building, if Nauda hasn't killed them all. Why not try to find them?" She nodded. "Okay. What's your plan? Why don't you use the scrying glass to see where Nauda is?" Nathaniel shifted. "Well..." "He's busted," the Jinni said. "Set the imp free. Big mistake, in my opinion."
"I can answer for myself," Nathaniel growled. He found it particularly annoying to be interrupted by his own larynx.
Kitty smiled at him.
"Good for you. Well, see you later, then."
"Yes. Sure you'll be all right?" He felt a burst of impatience from the Jinni. His limbs quivered. He longed to give a leap, surge through the air.
"I'll be fine. Here, you'd better take this."
He ducked his head, lifted the amulet of Samarkand from around his neck, and held it out to her.
"Wear it," he said. "It'll protect you."
"Just against magic, mind," the Jinni added. "Not against physical attack, or tripping up, or banging your head, or stubbing your toe, or anything like that. But within its strictly limited parameters, it works pretty well." Kitty hesitated.
"I do have some resilience," she began. "Maybe I shouldn't."
"Not enough to cope with Nauda," Nathaniel said. "Especially after what you've been through. Please." She put the necklace over her head.
"Thanks," she said. "Good luck."
"You too." There was nothing more to say. The moment had come. Nathaniel strode to the doorway, chin foremost, eyes somber and purposeful. He did not look back. A mound of debris from the broken door littered the floor. He stepped carefully over it, at the very moment that the jinni forced his legs into a skip and a jump. His feet collided, he tripped, sprawled, dropped the staff, and rolled head across heels over the debris and out through the door. "Suavely done," Bartimaeus said. Nathaniel made no audible response. Scooping up the staff of Gladstone, he trudged off down the corridor. A scene of inventive devastation unfolded at the Hall of Statues, where the marble heads of every deceased Prime Minister had been ripped from their torsos and apparently used to play a game of bowls. The broken council table sat near the wall. Around it, on the seven chairs, the bodies of various magicians had been placed in comical positions, as if in ghastly conclave. The room had suffered every kind of magical assault, sporadic and at random. Areas of floor, wall, and ceiling were broken, pierced, blackened, melted, and cut away. Smoking fragments showed where the rugs had been. Corpses lay higgledy-piggledy, forlorn, broken, like discarded toys. At the far end of the hall, a giant hole had been blasted in the stonework. Cold air came gusting through it. "Look at the pentacles," Nathaniel said suddenly. "I am looking. I've got your eyes, haven't I? And I agree with you." "What?" "What you're thinking. They've destroyed them systematically. They want to make it harder for any magicians who survived." Every pentacle had been somehow defaced or ruined. The mosaic circles torn up and scattered, the careful lines shot to fragments by casual bursts of fire. It was just like the scenes in the Forum at Rome, when the barbarians came knocking at the gate, and the citizens rose up against the ruling magicians. They'd begun by destroying the pentacles, too. Nathaniel shook his head. "That's irrelevant," he said. "Stick to the job in hand." "I am. Can I help it if you raid my memories?" Nathaniel didn't answer. He had caught sight of faces he recognized lying amid the rubble. The corners of his mouth clamped down. "Let's go," he said. "What's with the retrospective grief? You didn't like them anyway." "We need to speed up." "All right. Leave the movement to me." This was the most peculiar sensation of all. To relax your muscles, to deliberately cut off all command from them, yet feel them tense and spring, move with great harmonious sweeps and bounds, feel them surging with an exuberance that was not human. Nathaniel kept tight hold of the staff. Other than this, he allowed the jinni free rein. With a single bound, he had crossed the hall, landed on a fallen block. A pause. His head moved left and right. Then he was away again. A giant stride, then another. He ducked down through the hole in the wall, soared up into another room, dark, ravaged, filled with debris. He did not get a chance to focus on it. He was too busy trying to cope with his lurching stomach, with the thrill of the energies awoken within him. Up into the air and down again. Out of this room and through another. Past a staircase blown to matchwood. Across a mess of masonry, boulder-sized. Through a gaping arch of ruptured stone, out onto the streets of Whitehall. They landed, knees bent, ready to spring again. Nathaniel's head was cocked, his eyes swiveled, they saw all planes. "Oh, no," he whispered. "Oh, yes," the jinni said. Whitehall was aflame. Above the rooftops the lowest clouds glowed pink and orange. Fiery light drained between them into chasms of blackness, pricked with stars. The great ministries of government, where imperial business never ceased, stood dark and empty. All lights were off, the street lamps too. A building to the north, was it the education ministry? Nathaniel could not tell, had a fire burning on an upper floor. Little flickering darts of redness waved from the windows like autumn leaves. Smoke rose to mingle with the clouds. Other blazes crackled in buildings opposite. It all had an unreal quality, like illusions in one of Makepeace's plays. The street was empty, save for debris, toppled lamps and statues, and, lying dark and small like scalded ants, scattered human bodies. Here a limousine had been hurled through the glass front of the Ministry of Transport. There one of the vast sculptures, Respect for Authority, lay in ruins, its monolithic feet all that remained upon its pedestal. The war memorials had been likewise shattered, the road half-blocked with granite. From up the slow curve of Whitehall, from the direction of Trafalgar Square, a dull explosion sounded.
"That way," Nathaniel said.
His legs sprang, he soared high, dived low. At his height he was level with the second story of the buildings. Each time he dropped to earth he gave it only the lightest, glancing touch before springing on. His boots rattled loosely on his feet.
"You know I'm wearing the seven-league boots,"
he gasped. The wind took his breath away.
"Of course I know. I am you for the moment, like it or not.
We don't need them yet. Are you ready with the staff? There's something up ahead." Past the war memorials, past abandoned cars, the body of a wolf lay in the middle of the road, along with tatters of barbed wire, warning signs, the remnants of a police cordon. Ahead was Trafalgar Square. Nelson's column rose into the night, bathed in a mustard-yellow glow. Small explosions echoed back and forth beneath it. Among the stalls and booths of the tourist market, little shadows fled and scattered. Something bounded at their heels. Nathaniel came to rest at the edge of the square. He bit his lip.
"It's chasing the people.
Bit of sport. Probably thinks she's back at the Colosseum." Slaves and prisoners of war were given iron knives and sent into Rome's great arena to combat captive gin. The Roman elite used to just love the comedy chases and all the hilarious methods of death.
"Look,
that man survived a detonation. Some of these guys have resilience." Nathaniel placed a hand over his eyes.
"Your thoughts went in different directions there. Keep it simple, I can't cope."
"Okay. Staff ready?" "Well then, here we go." Before Nathaniel could prepare himself, his legs had given a bound. He was across the road, in among the burning stalls, down through the smoke, past a cowering woman and a small child. A hop, a leap. Straight ahead, standing by a fountain, bent like a beast, the body of Clive Jenkins. Pale green fires burned behind his eyes. His mouth hung slack, distended. Yellow vapour curled from his hands. Nathaniel stared in shock, with difficulty regained control. He raised the staff. His legs leapt once more. He found himself flying through the air. At his back, an explosion. Tiny pieces of concrete struck the side of his face. He landed on the head of a lion statue, directly beneath the column.
"What did you move for?" he shouted. "I was just getting ready."
"Another second, and we'd have been blown apart. Got to be faster. Narian's an Afrit. She doesn't waste time." I first encountered Narian in Africa during the Scipio campaigns. Her favourite manifestation was as a lissom belly dancer who would lure...
"Will you stop doing that? I'm trying to concentrate."
Nathaniel focused the staff, readied himself.
"Well, hurry it up. She's getting closer. If we had the amulet, we'd be laughing. Why'd you have to give it to Kitty anyhow?"
"Yeah, I know. Fair point. Isn't it hard to maintain an argument when you can read each other's mind? Uh-oh. Detonation coming. I'm going to jump."
"Go on, then."
"Sure. You don't mind?"
"Just do it."
Out from the smoke came a horribly hopping figure. The Afrit within had mastered the limbs, yet chose to move on tiptoe rather than with human tread. A flash of golden light blew the lion statue apart. But Bartimaeus had already pulled the correct tendons, engaged the muscles. Nathaniel found himself somersaulting directly over the monster's head, landing at its back.
"Now,"
Bartimaeus said. Nathaniel spoke a single word. The staff was triggered. A shaft of white light, diamond hard, narrow as a hand's breadth, shot from the centre of the carved pentacle at its head. The ground shuddered. Nathaniel's teeth rattled in his jaw. The light missed Clive Jenkins' body by several feet and struck Nelson's column, snapping it like a breadstick. The white light vanished. Nathaniel looked up. The Afrit looked up. In utter silence, the column teetered, shifted, and slowly, slowly seemed to grow. Then it was collapsing on them with a whistling almost like a scream, and Bartimaeus was launching them sideways through the fabric of a burning stall down onto the paving, hard upon the wounded shoulder, as the column fell to earth and sliced the square in two. Nathaniel was on his feet in an instant. Pain flared in his collarbone. A voice of fury was shouting in his mind. "You've got to direct it properly. I'll do it next time."
"No, you won't. The demon, where is it?"
"Long gone by now, no doubt. You really messed that up big time."
"Now listen."
A movement a few meters away attracted his notice. Four white faces. A woman and her children crouching between the stalls. Nathaniel held out his hand.
"It's all right," he said. "I'm a magician."
The woman gave a little scream. The children started and clustered close to her. A sardonic voice sounded in his head. "Oh, nice one. Very reassuring. Why not offer to cut their throats, too, while you're about it?" Nathaniel cursed inwardly. Outwardly, he tried to smile.
"I'm on your side," he said. "Stay here. I'll—"
He looked up suddenly. The voice in his head. "See it?" Through the burning tatters of the stall, amid the clouds of dust that rose from the shattered pieces of the fallen column, he caught the glint of green. He refocused. On the higher planes he glimpsed the narrowed eyes more easily, the furtive, lolloping movement in the dark. Nearer and nearer Clive Jenkins's body came, tiptoeing from stall to stall, hoping to catch him unawares. Bartimaeus spoke quickly. "It'll be a flux this time."
"Because I'm a jinni, that's how I know these things. Fluxes cover a wide area. She'll hope to disable you. I can put a shield over us, but that'll deflect the stream from the staff."
"Can you put a shield over those people?"
"Do that, then. We won't need one."
Nathaniel allowed his hand to lift. Energies coursed through the outstretched fingers. A blue sphere extended over the huddled commoners, sealing them in. He turned back toward the square. Dust rose. Black fragments drifted from the burning fabric of the stalls. No tiptoeing demon to be seen.
"Where is it?"
"How should I know?"
"You've not got eyes in the back of your head. I can only look where you do."
"All right, all right. Calm down."
"I'm calm. It's you who isn't. All these weird chemicals shooting through your system, pepping you up. It's no wonder humans don't think straight."
"There."
"No. Just the wind flapping that canvas. Ooh, made me jump, that did." Nathaniel scanned the square. The staff hummed in his hand. He tried to tune out the constant flitter of the jinni's voice, its flood of memories. At times they almost swamped him.
Where was the demon hiding?
Behind the column's splintered base? Doubtful. Too far away.
Where, then?
"It's beyond me," Bartimaeus said. "Maybe she's run off." Nathaniel took a few tentative steps forward. His skin crawled. He felt the imminence of danger. Far away across the square he saw a railing, a set of steps leading below the pavement. It was the subway, the underground. Below the square stretched a network of tunnels, connecting with the trains, carrying pedestrians beneath the roads. And those tunnels came up at different points about the square.
"Turn!"
He thought the order, relaxed his muscles, allowed the jinni to do the rest. As he spun, he spoke the word, directed the staff. A bolt of white light beamed out, cut through the air, atomized the body of Clive Jenkins that came creeping up behind him. 1 minute the demon was there, clammy hand outstretched to deal a flux. The next it had vanished, along with the subway entrance beyond it. Foul ash blew upon the molten pavement. "Good thinking, that was," the jinni said. "Didn't remember Narian being that sneaky." Nathaniel took a slow breath. He crossed to where the little group crouched beneath their shield and waved a hand. Bartimaeus removed the sphere. The woman stood up quickly, clutching the children close.
"Whitehall's the safest way,"
Nathaniel began.
"The demons are gone from there, I think. Go that way, but do not fear, madam. I'll—"
He halted. The woman had turned from him. Face blank, eyes sullen and remote, she ushered the children away between the stalls.
"What do you expect?"
The jinni's voice cut in on his surprise.
"You and your kind got her into this mess in the first place.
She won't be thanking you in a hurry, whatever you do. Don't worry, though, Nat. You're not totally alone. You've always got me.
Laughter bubbled unbidden through his mind. For a few seconds Nathaniel stood where he was, head a little bent, looking out upon the desolation of the square. Then he set his shoulders, firmed his grip upon the staff, rapped the heel of his boot once upon the ground, and was gone. Chapter 34 Kitty. Kitty located the prisoners far faster than she had expected. The slowest part was at the outset, as she geared herself up to leave the little room. When she first stood, every muscle in her body protested to the skies. She shuddered as if from extreme cold. Her head felt light and watery. But she did not capsize. "I've just got to relearn it," she thought. "Remind my body what it can do." And it was true that with each shuffling step, her confidence grew. She made it to the cache of weapons piled beside the door. She grimaced, bent her knees, crouched and held that position, wobbling and cursing as she rummaged through the pile. Jolt sticks, inferno sticks, elemental spheres, familiar objects from the resistance years. She had no bag, but tucked an inferno and a jolt stick in her belt. Two spheres, with difficulty, fitted in the tattered pockets of her jacket. She removed Ptolemy's Apocrypha and set it, not without a certain reverence, on the floor. It had served its purpose well. Among the magical objects lay a silver disc, smooth and razor-edged. Subduing a slight, unaccountable aversion, she added it to a pocket. Then, supporting herself against the wall, she clawed herself back to her feet. Carefully, little by little, she set off out of the room, over the shattered fragments of the door, down the corridor, past the bleak expanse of the ruined hall of statues. She had a memory in her mind of plaintive sounds coming from behind a door close to where Nathaniel and she had been imprisoned. As she went, Kitty was conscious of a strange division within her. Never had she felt so appallingly weak, so tentatively tied to earthly strength. Yet by the same token, neither had she ever felt so wholly sure of herself as she did now. Often in the past she had been filled with reckless certainty, with joyful confidence in her youth and vigour. This was not like that. It was a calmer feeling, quieter, entirely unconnected with physical things, and lacking the edginess they tended to involve. It was a kind of implacable assurance. She felt it radiate from her as she shuffled along. Her first test did not dent this feeling in the slightest. At the point where the corridor broadened out, close to a set of stairs, Kitty encountered one of the demons. Probably it was the last to take possession of a body. Certainly it had not mastered it with any great success. Its host had been a tall, thin man with blonde and lanky hair, dressed in dark clothes of obvious expense. Now the clothes were ripped and torn, the hair disordered, the eyes opaque like sea glass. The legs stumbled from one side of the corridor to the other, the arms thrashing blindly. A feral growling issued from his throat, and with every now and then angry words in an unknown language. The head turned. It caught sight of Kitty. A yellow gleam burned behind the eyes. Kitty halted, waiting. The demon's interest showed itself in a sudden, wild ululation that set the glass rattling in the cabinets along the corridor. It decided to attack, but seemed in doubt exactly how to issue a magical bombardment. First it raised a leg, pointed a foot, and blew its own shoe off. Next it tried an elbow, with comparable success. Lastly, with painful hesitation, a hand was raised, a trembling finger extended, and a bolt of lilac light was delivered forth to strike the amulet of Samarkand and be at once absorbed. The demon inspected its finger in annoyance. Kitty took the jolt stick from her belt, stepped quietly forward, and sent a burst of shimmering blue current rattling through its body. Swathed in black smoke, the demon jittered, jigged, flung itself backward, crashed through the balustrade, and fell 4 meters to the steps below. Kitty went her way. Minutes later, she came to the door she had remembered. Listening closely, Kitty detected muffled groans. She tried the door, found it locked, and blew it open with the first of her elemental spheres. Once the final winds had died away, she stepped inside. The room was not large, and what space it had was blotted out by recumbent bodies. At first sight, Kitty feared the worst. Then she saw that all were neatly tied and gagged, just as they had been left by Makepeace's imps so many hours before. Most were secured by the minimum of ropes and cords, but one or two were swathed in sheets or thick wads of black netting. There were perhaps 20 individuals in the room, sardine-packed, head to toe. To Kitty's great relief, she saw that many of them were moving, with sad little wriggles, like maggots in a jar. One or two pairs of staring eyes caught sight of her. Their owners writhed and uttered pleading moans. She took a moment to gather herself. Her legs shook with the effort of her stroll thus far. Then she spoke as clearly as she could.
"I'm here to help you," she said. "Wait as patiently as you can. I'll try to cut you free."
This pronouncement induced a remarkable flurry of squirms and wails. Legs thrashed, heads bucked and twisted. Kitty was nearly knocked over by the flailing of the bodies next to her.
"If you don't lie quiet," she said severely, "I'll leave you."
Instant quietness among the prone magicians.
"That's better. Now then."
With clumsy fingers, she took the silver disc from her pocket, and holding it carefully so as not to slice her fingers, set to upon the nearest bonds. The cords parted like butter to a hot knife. Cramped hands and feet moved tentatively, their owner emitting cries of pain. Without ceremony, Kitty removed the gag.
"When you can stand," she said, "find something sharp and help me untie the others."
She moved on to the next magician. Within 10 minutes, the room was filled with limping, stretching men and women, some sitting, others standing first on one foot, then on the other, trying to wring the pins and needles from their numb and swollen limbs. There was no conversation. The bodies had been freed, but the minds remained wrapped in shock and disbelief. Kitty worked silently on the penultimate captive, a large gentleman swathed in netting. He seemed inert. Blood had seeped through the cloth around his head. Beside her, the first person she had freed, a young woman with mousy hair, struggled with the cords of the last magician. This one, covered in a coarse grey blanket, was very much alive. Her legs kicked back and forth with furious impatience. Kitty passed the silver disc across.
"Here." "Thanks."
In moments, the swathes of net and blanket had been removed, and the two captives lay revealed. One, a woman with long dark hair, hanging over a red and puffy face, sprang instantly to her feet and shrieked with agony as her cramp kicked in. The other, an immense old man with a badly beaten face, lay still. His eyes were closed. His breathing came in ragged gasps. The dark-haired woman leaned back against a wall and massaged a leg. She gave a snarl of pain and fury.
"Who? Who is responsible for this? I'll kill them. I'll kill them, I swear it."
Kitty was busy talking to the woman with mousy hair.
"He's in a bad way. Someone needs to get him to a hospital." "I'll fix it," the woman said.
She looked around the room, picked out a spotty youth.
"George, can you oblige?"
"All right, Miss Piper."
"Wait."
This was Kitty. Wearily, she tried to rise, extended a shaking hand.
"Can you help me up, please?"
"Thanks."
She turned to face the room. "You all need to know what's happened. The situation outside may be difficult. Demons have broken loose in London." Gasps. Oaths. The assembled faces registered sagging dismay. Young and old, they gaped at her, vulnerable and uncomprehending. Gone was any vestige of magicianly assurance. Now they were nothing but humans, panic-stricken, leaderless, stripped bare. Kitty held up a hand.
"Listen," she said, "and I'll tell you." "One moment."
The black-haired woman reached out and clutched at Kitty's arm.
"First, who the hell are you? I don't recognize your face. Or," she curled a lip, "your dirty little clothes. I don't think you're even a magician."
"Correct," Kitty snapped. "I'm a commoner, but you'd do well to shut up and hear me out if you want to avoid being killed."
The woman's eyes widened.
How dare you?
Yes, shut your trap, Farah, a man said.
The woman seemed to choke. She looked around wildly, but let go of Kitty's arm. This one exception apart, everyone in the room seemed eager, grateful even, to listen to what Kitty had to say. Whether it was their residual shock that kept them quiet, or whether they glimpsed in the grey-haired girl with the lined and weary face something that commanded unequivocal respect was hard to say. But they listened with complete attention as Kitty told them what had happened.
"What about the rest of us?"
one of the elder men said plaintively.
"There were 100 at least sitting in that theatre. Surely they haven't all."
"I'm not sure," Kitty said. "Perhaps there are other rooms of prisoners that the demons forgot, or decided to ignore. You'll have to see. But many of you are dead."
"What about Mr. Devereux?"
a woman whispered.
"Or Jessica Whitwell, or—"
Kitty held up her hand.
"I'm sorry, but I don't know. I think it likely that many of the most senior magicians have been possessed or killed."
"This one hasn't,"
the dark-haired woman spoke savagely.
"Until they are found, I am the sole council member remaining, so I am now in charge. We must get to our pentacles and conjure our slaves. I shall contact my police wolves forthwith. The renegade demons will be found and destroyed."
"Two things," Kitty said quietly. "No, three. This man must be seen to first. Can anyone provide transport?"
"I can."
The spotty youth bent beside the limp body.
"Going to need three of us for this. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Vole, can you lend a hand? Help me get into a limo."
Assistance came. The men departed, supporting the invalid between them. A clap of the hands, the dark-haired woman was by the door.
"To the pentacles," she commanded. "No time to waste."
Nobody moved.
"I think this lady had something more to say,"
an older man said, nodding toward Kitty.
"We should hear her out, don't you think, Ms. Farah? Out of courtesy, if nothing else."
Ms. Farah's lips twisted.
"But she's nothing but a—"
"I had two further points to make,"
Kitty said. She felt very tired now, light-headed. She needed to sit down. "No. Get a grip. Get the job done. The chief demon, Nauda, is very terrible. It would be suicide for you to approach him without the greatest possible weapon, and that is already being done." She looked around the silent group. A magician, another surviving council member— Kitty could not resist a sly glance at Ms. Farah here— has gone to meet it. He uses Gladstone's staff. She was only half surprised by the stifled exclamations of astonishment. Ms. Farah in particular seemed incensed.
"But Mr. Devereux has forbidden it," she cried. "Who would dare to—"
Kitty smiled.
"It is Nath, John Mandrake. You had better hope he is successful."
"Mandrake?"
Farah's face was pale with fury.
"He doesn't have the talent."
"The final thing I would like to say," Kitty went on remorselessly, "is that with this being so, the most important thing for us, for you, I should say, you are the magicians, you have the power, is to provide protection and guidance for the people. Since Makepeace imprisoned you all, there has been no leadership, no one to evacuate areas where the demons are at large. We risk mass casualties here, mass casualties. If we do not act, many commoners will die."
"Never bothered us before," a young man muttered at the back,
but general opinion was against him.
"What we need is a crystal," Piper said. "See where the demons are."
"Or a scrying bowl. Where do they keep them in this place?"
"Must be one. Come on."
"Let's get to the pentacles. I could summon an imp, send him off. We'll need more cars. Who here can drive?" "I can't. My man does that."
"Nor me."
At the door, a harsh, forced cough. Ms. Farah's face was haggard, her hair tangled and dishevelled, her mouth a thin-lipped slash. White hands pressed hard against the doorframe on either side. Her arms were bent, her shoulders slightly hunched. The posture gave her a faint resemblance to an inverted bat. Her gaze spat venom.
"Not one of you," she said, "is anything better than a junior minister. Most of you are scarcely even that. Just secretaries and desk-hands. Your knowledge of magic is painfully limited. Your judgment, it seems, is even worse.
The commoners will look after themselves. Some have resilience. No doubt they can repel a few detonations. There are, in any case, many of them. We can afford to lose a few.